This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Cornel West talks about institutional racism in the United States, a human rights approach to public education, and the security threat industry. Will you be the next designated terrorist?
But first, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on the warpath again, shouting that Syrian President Assad must go. We spoke with Tony Montero, professor of African American studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. He says that even if the U.S. can't achieve regime change in Syria, Washington is happy to create chaos.
The United States policy is based upon their ability to live with and manage instability. They prefer instability to a stable world order where nations like Libya or Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq, for that matter, have the option of joining nations like Russia or China or Iran or Venezuela in what is, in effect, a real New World Order, effectively an anti-imperialist New World Order.
The United States has long had a policy in Africa of creating chaos in regions that it can't control. Is it now extending that African policy globally?
That's right. And that's, I think, what the policy is. And I would say, keep your eye on Greece or Portugal, or others in that southern rim of the Eurozone or the European Union, which are now experiencing profound crisis, rather than, as would be, and I think will be the case in Greece, rather than live with a left-wing, a genuinely left-wing government of socialists and communists and left-wing social democrats, the West would prefer prolonged instability. In the case of Greece, that would probably mean the financing and promoting of neo-fascist elements who would try to trump the normal political process, which the left is winning by resorting to violence and thus producing, as you call it, chaos and instability.
And in fact, in Greece, in the recent elections, although the left made great gains, the fascists did as well. And there's a long history, of course, of fascism in Italy and in Spain and in Portugal.
Exactly. And in Germany. Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely. But now we're entering that second round. And it will be interesting to see if the gains that the fascists made in the first round of the election will hold up in the second round. I think, and I have a sneaky suspicion, that the right, the far right, will lose, as will the center right, as the broad left gains in the second round of elections.
As this crisis of capitalism becomes so acute in Europe, it's taking on different characteristics than the crisis that we have in the United States.
Right. And I think the big difference is that the financial and economic crisis in Europe has produced a political crisis where the left is in the ascendancy in these countries. And it takes different forms, different places, and a lot is determined by the depth of the crisis. But certainly in countries like Spain, Portugal, and Greece, and I hope in Italy, a genuine left-united front will emerge to challenge, first of all, these technocratic caretaker governments that were non-elected, but also to effectively challenge the center-right. We saw it in France. It's, you know, kind of murky in some ways, but we saw it in France. Hopefully the same thing in Italy, but clearly in the vanguard of this is the movement, the left movement in Greece. Here in the United States, because of the infantile and backward nature of left politics in this country, the turning of the economic crisis into a political crisis where the left and progressive forces can challenge the two parties of monopoly capitalism, because we don't have that situation, we're looking at this prolonged and long drawn out deterioration in the lives of the people without an effective fight back. And if I might add, that is precisely what Wisconsin represents, the failure of a genuine left politics, a labor leadership that wants to challenge austerity and anti-union policies by playing by the rules of the people that got you into this situation.
As my colleague Bruce Dixon writes about in the current issue of Black Agenda Report, what we saw in Wisconsin was a movement that was turned into an electoral campaign.
Oh, that's all. That's right. In other words, the labor leadership undermined the movement and inflicted a defeat on itself. It was not Scott Walker and the right that defeated the movement. It was the labor leadership, through its tactics, that defeated the movement, that could have defeated the right wing, especially in the state legislature. And they went for this phony victory and of recall, and the people didn't really understand what it was. But the other thing is, the policy in Wisconsin is the policy that the AFL-CIO is pursuing in the 2012 election. Prediction. The outcome in Wisconsin anticipates the outcome in November.
Explain, please.
The AFL-CIO announced a couple of months ago that they're going to contribute over $400 million to the reelection of Barack Obama and Democrats. Now, rather than a movement against austerity, against union busting, a movement to organize the working class to join the trade union movement with these broader movements against poverty, against war, against repression, they're pursuing a narrow sectarian right-wing policy of just re-electing a president that himself is anti-labor. That was the same policy pursued in Wisconsin. And therefore, the failure in Wisconsin anticipates the failure in November. The same tactics, the same policy of capitulation, of no struggle, of undermining movements, of undermining the building of coalitions and united fronts, that policy will lead to the defeat of the labor movement.
$400 million could buy one hell of a grassroots movement.
That's right. And a third party, which masses, millions and millions of people, are just eagerly awaiting. But this labor leadership is so tied up with finance capital, so tied up with the Pentagon and the war makers in this world, that they cannot break loose. And until the masses of working people break loose from this leadership, in the same way that African Americans have to break loose from the sellout leadership that is at the helm of our movement, until these things occur, we're not going to have an effective struggle against all of these problems that we face. And I would say this, Glenn, if the left, and especially the black left, wants to have an idea of what they should do, I say look to Greece. Study Greece. That's where some of the answers are to be found. Besides a left program, and I would argue there's several left programs in Greece at this point, but what they have to do is to develop a broad left front. Sectarianism in the left or disunity in the left will lead to fissures that give opportunities to the right and the neo-fascists. That is the experience of Germany in the 1920s. The ineffectiveness or the inability of the social democrats and the communists to unite. However, hopefully, a united front of the left will develop, even though I'm certain there are multiple candidates of left parties that will be running, but unity of the left is the key.
Here in the United States, we used to think that we had a coherent black left, but much of it, if not most of it, has been subsumed into the Obama campaign.
That's right. And, you know, the reason why we could talk about a black left is because we knew that the black masses were to the left of the American political system. So if you spoke from the left, you always had an audience and a base because black folk were to the left of the major parties and the politics of the American population. However, what happened is that a new leadership emerges, and I would put this leadership as consolidating itself mainly in the 1990s and primarily around this movement created by Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council. That leadership, which has prioritized electoral politics over mass movements and grassroots politics, has, with Obama, ascended to a position of almost unchallenged leadership of black people. At least that's all black people see in terms of leadership. What occurred with the Obama movement is that a good part of what I call the soft black left, the weak black left, they call themselves the pragmatic left, capitulated to the Obama movement. And therefore, you got this new alliance, which really becomes a centrist, liberal, left alliance, which then went after the genuine left. You see what I'm saying? The consistent left among black people. And I would say those of us who are connected to the consistent left, although at this point we can say, look at Obama, we politically have a position that we didn't have in 2008. But still, the soft or pragmatic left is hiding behind its relationship basically with the liberal center forces in the black community. And that's kind of what's making it difficult for us, even in 2012, with all of the contradictions in the society, with the poverty, with the betrayal of the Obama forces and the black Democrats. We're still fighting what I consider to be an uphill battle.
They are even more silent than pragmatic. This class of black misleadership won't even speak up on the economic front, and in fact has been silent on almost every issue except voting rights, and voting rights have to do with their alliance with the Democratic Party.
I could not agree with you more. I mean, I think that if you needed any evidence of betrayal and sellout, it is the fact that they are silent on poverty, they are silent on the incarceration and murders of black youth, the prison industrial complex, and of course, they say nothing about war and peace. In fact, they praise Obama for his militarism and his drone wars in the Middle East. So yeah, it's betrayal of a huge character.
And say not a mumbling word about the nullification of due process, something so basic to what we used to call the civil rights movement.
No question. So they have to make this into a personality contest election. I don't think it's going to work. If you were to ask me at this point, I do not see Obama winning this election because no Democrat can win, black, white, or otherwise, can win without massive turnout and voting by black people and other racial minorities. He needs a big Latino vote, especially in the West and Southwest, and I don't think it's going to be there. They're going to sit out this election. He needs a massive turnout of black people. I don't think it's forthcoming. And the other side of it, he needs that big youth turnout. I don't think he's getting it. I have to say, Glenn, if I were to predict Obama loses in November,
Romney is not likely to scare activity into black folks as a Gingrich might.
No, that's right. You see, for most of the campaign, I predict Romney will try to keep Obama as close to him as possible. And then, in the last few weeks, highlight the differences. The Obama people want to highlight the differences or exaggerate the differences as soon as possible and keep hammering at what perceived differences in order to kind of mobilize their base with this lesser of evils thing. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think the economy is too bad. I think Europe is going to pull the U.S. economy back into recession. And not just Europe. I think Europe and Asia will push the United States back into recession or near recession.
Obama is styling himself as the war president and flaunting it. Might that be his response?
To me, it's desperation, because this should be an election about the economy. But you see, Obama's been in bed with the 1% so long and has not done anything seriously to stimulate the economy that he has no record to run on. So I just don't think that world president thing is going to work for him as it worked for, let us say, Bush in 2004.
That was Professor Tony Montero at Temple University in Philadelphia.
The U.S. government compiles ever-growing lists and categories of people it considers threats to national security. New York journalist Don DeBar appeared on a recent program of Press TV. He said the U.S. has a long history of repressing dissent.
They've actually just continued a war that's been taking place for at least 100 years, and certainly by the FBI since its inception. When J. Edgar Hoover became the director of the FBI, 45, 50 years before the end of his career, one of the first people that he attacked was Marcus Garvey, and, you know, the black nationalist, quote-unquote, of his time. The entire idea of having a threat from subversives enabled the creation of the FBI. The United States political culture at that time looked at a national police force as something that was anathema to the political structure. Hoover used first the ideas of Reds and black nationalists and other scary people to enable the FBI, and then when people began to identify with some of the positions of, for example, the Communist Party in the early 1930s because of the economic conditions, he changed the enemy to the rum runners and the gangsters who were doing bank robberies and shoot-em-ups, and they used it in the entire process, large public relations campaign, to enable a national police force, which since then has been conducting war against dissent in this country. You only need to look at the Pentagon Papers, the COINTELPRO Papers by Warren Churchill and Jim Vanderwall, and an entire chunk of that history is well documented. And also, to look at legislation that was introduced by Cynthia McKinney that sought to pry open just a couple of areas of that stuff and the resistance to that. Finally, just yesterday here in New York State, in the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York State, in the system in New York State, there was a decision that was made denying a historian who had made a request to look into complaints of allegations that people who were teachers or in the education system in New York City were communists. She wanted to look at these allegations and learn the identity of the people who made them And even now, 50-some-odd years later, the courts have said that since those people were snitches, essentially, depending on anonymity, that their anonymity even today should be protected from the scrutiny of historians.
Don DeBar on Press TV.
Black Agenda Report's own Bruce Dixon appeared on that same program. Dixon said the pace of government suppression is increasing. Nowadays, curtailing free speech is big business.
One place to start is that when 9/11 happened, George W. Bush was president. George W. Bush was the first MBA president. An MBA, for your viewers who don't know it, is a Master's of Business Administration. It's an advanced degree you get in colleges and universities here that qualifies you to become a businessman. And what has happened in the wake of 9/11 is we have made policing and certain aspects of policing businesses. The Department of Homeland Security has an enormous budget, but it's mostly not government officials. It's mostly not government employees. They are mostly private contractors of different kinds and private companies with contractual relationships to the government. I'll bet you anything that this study that the FBI is using and these series of studies were drawn up by private contractors who are doing this stuff to drum up business. Because after all, that's what you learn in business school. You learn to anticipate what the government is doing and to get out in front of it by putting yourself and your company in a position to give them what they want. So if the government is going to ramp up policing, you've got to have your company there to manufacture reams of information on how to police and who to police and who threats are. So manufacturing these threats has not just become a practice of bad police work, it's become good business for a lot of American businesses. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing a business model applied to security. So that it's a growth industry, and look out, you might be the next threat.
That was Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch claim to look out for civil liberties around the world, but they've wound up acting as cheerleaders for America's wars. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
Under President Obama, U.S. imperialism masquerades as the protector of the planet's peoples. Each American aggression, every violation of centuries of international law, is couched in the rhetoric of humanitarian intervention, a gift from the strong to the weak. Wars of pure pillage and conquest are heralded as acts of nobility and service to humankind. The former colonizers from Europe and their cousins from the United States, the nation that grew rich from indigenous genocide and African slavery, have assumed a responsibility to protect the very same Asians, Africans, and Latin Americans they were slaughtering, it seems like, only yesterday. But if yesterday these Europeans and Americans had no regard for the lives and liberties of any of the colored or non-Christian peoples of the world, in today's geopolitical configuration, human rights has become the imperial watchword, and therefore the Western so-called human rights organizations take on strategic importance. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are essentially weapons in an imperial arsenal. Their value to the empire increased exponentially when Barack Obama adopted humanitarian intervention as a pillar of American war doctrine. Who better than self-styled human rights activists to justify humanitarian wars? In mid-May, as thousands of anti-war activists protested the NATO summit meeting in Chicago, Amnesty International hosted a so-called shadow summit of apologists for the U.S. war in Afghanistan. They were joined by the ghoulish Madeleine Albright, the former Clinton Secretary of State, who said the price was worth it when questioned about the death of thousands of children as a result of U.S. sanctions against Iraq. Albright, the warmonger, and Amnesty International agree that the U.S. should remain in Afghanistan as long as it takes for the sake of Afghan women.
Of course, it was the United States that spent billions of dollars in a joint venture with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan to empower Islamists to overthrow the left-wing Soviet-backed government that had pursued full equality for Afghanistan's women. Yet, only a few decades later, Amnesty International trumpets the Americans as great defenders of Afghan women's rights. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch denounce Russia and China as enemies of human rights in Syria because they've resisted a catastrophic Western military assault on that country. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch actively campaign for wars, and they always turn out to be the same wars that Washington is planning to wage. They provided much of the propaganda ammunition for the U.S. and European war against Libya, giving credibility to lies about an imminent massacre in Benghazi. Both organizations are imposters on the world scene, pretending to care for human rights while advocating that the U.S. and its friends trample on the national sovereignty of weaker states, as if human rights can exist outside the framework of international law. As far as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are concerned, human rights are whatever the empire says they are. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are simply mercenaries for empire and sworn enemies of international law.
Filmmaker Michael Moore and activist Professor Cornel West recently made a joint appearance at New York's Hunter College as a benefit for the Brecht Forum. Professor West told the crowd that the United States remains a profoundly racist society.
If precious white brothers and sisters go into jail at the level of intensity in the last 30 years, so you end up with 300,000 in the 1980s and 2.6 million today, it would be a national emergency talking about every day, every week, every month, every year. The fact, it's a matter of class. If black middle class brothers and sisters were going to jail at the same level of intensity as our precious black poor brothers and sisters in terms of the prison industrial complex, we have different kind of black leadership. You have different kind of black pastors, different kind of black cultural reflection. That's institutional. And there's no way that somebody coming from another planet and looked at the prison industrial complex and looked at the hoods and looked at the schools and the 50% levels of unemployment and underemployment and the decrepit housing and say, this is a profoundly racist society. They would be right at the institutional level. But they would say, oh, but interpersonally we like each other now because we used to lynch them, you know. They would say, that's a fascinating history. You're making progress on the interpersonal level. And we laugh to keep from crying. That legacy of white supremacy is still operating at that institutional level, but it kicks in with class and poverty, so we got enough middle class Negroes around to provide examples of success. And those same middle class Negroes oftentimes have become too indifferent to the suffering of their cousins locked into the basement, and you end up hiding and concealing this. I don't even like to talk about race in that abstract sense, right? We're talking about a legacy of white supremacy. And I would be saying the same thing if black brothers and sisters had done that to white brothers and sisters. If black supremacy was operating the same way white supremacy lasts 400 years, then I'd be a critic of black supremacy. I'd be with my white brothers and sisters against black supremacy. It ain't skin pigmentation, even though I like being black, but it's a question of morality and integrity and what kind of human being you want to be. Trying to be right and just. That's what we're talking about. And that's what we got to connect and talk about.
That was Professor Cornel West at Hunter College in New York City.
Lots of people who describe themselves as liberal or progressive nevertheless support charter schools, at least for the inner city. Journalist Lisa Featherstone was especially curious about New York State Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries, who's running for Congress from Brooklyn.
Hakeem Jeffries I thought he was a particularly interesting person to look at because he is progressive in many ways. He's fought for New Yorkers' rights on stop and frisk issues, decriminalization of small quantities of marijuana. He's fought for more affordable housing where I live, which is a huge issue. So I thought it was particularly striking that he's really on the forefront of efforts to open up a public school system to private interests. He has co-sponsored the bill to lift the cap on charter schools. And as I'm sure your listeners probably know, charter schools are privately run schools that are allowed to receive public money. He's also been the recipient of lots of money from the financial sector and from those interests that are pushing for these kinds of education reforms. The money at this point, it's not huge amounts of money, but these relationships are obviously shaping his views on these issues, and I think in that he's certainly typical of many Democrats at this point.
Well, this is pretty fundamental in terms of one's worldview. We're talking about associating with and taking money from and sharing a worldview with people who are hedge funders, all kinds of anti-union people, the right. kind of people who also don't agree with the kind of agenda that you say Hakeem Jeffries, other than on school issues, has adopted.
It's fundamentally at odds. I mean, the Working Families Party called him the candidate of the 99% because of his support for higher minimum wages, a wide variety of policies that do indeed benefit the 99%. However, the 99% most certainly needs unions, most certainly needs public schools that are not run by financiers, needs to have democratic control of its own school system. You know, I mean, these are very fundamental issues. If we don't have organizations to represent us as workers, and if we don't have some democratic measure of control over our own institutions, we have no control over anything at all, really. I wish that Hakeem Jeffries' constituents would call more attention to this issue and would call more attention to this contradiction. And it's one that I would like to see more liberal Democrats called out on, because I think it is fundamental. It affects most of our daily lives. It's not entirely clear to me why this exception exists on so many fronts. I mean, you know, if you look at the Center for American Progress, is a Democratic Party think tank in Washington, D.C., and, you know, if you look at their education platform, it's virtually indistinguishable from that of the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing, Republican-leaning think tank. And these ideologies around this issue have in many ways converged. And I think people are not really recognizing the contradictions.
Well, maybe we're using the liberal word, the liberal terminology, too liberally.
Too liberally. Probably so, Glenn. Yes.
For example, you were speaking of that Democratic Party think tank. We also remember that the Democratic Leadership Council, which was the right wing of the Democratic Party, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, also had a think tank, and it had progressive in its name, obviously.
That's true. These are easily abused terms. However, in the case of Hakeem Jeffries, he's someone who's certainly progressive except for this issue. And I think that that sort of thing is becoming alarming. And I think that one of the reasons that we're seeing that, and Diane Ravitch has written quite a lot and spoken quite a lot about this, you know, she's somebody who helped to shape the right-wing agenda working for various right-wing think tanks on education. She's an education historian. And she eventually changed her mind and saw that these privatization policies were not working, were not leading to better education for our nation's children. She says that the reason that the privatization agenda has been so widely accepted among liberals is that the right really planned it that way. You know, that they said, look, if we tell this story as poor children, poor black children need more school options, and these privatized entities are going to uplift the poor, they reasoned, liberals are really going to fall for that. And it absolutely, their plan pretty much did work, that the liberals were going to embrace it if it was fed to them as we're going to uplift and empower poor folks. And unfortunately, that really isn't the case. There's actually no evidence that these privatized entities lead to better education. Some of them are wonderful. Most of them do no better job than the public schools. Many of them do a great deal worse. So we see the free market is far from a magic bullet.
Could the influx of money be the thing that changed the equation for Hakeem Jeffries and others?
It certainly doesn't hurt. I think there's a heavy dose of ideology, as Diane Ravitch has argued, but certainly we see money. I mean, it's no accident that Hakeem Jeffries started to change his tune around the time that he contemplated running for Congress. That simply takes so much more money than running for a statewide local office. So around that time, he did start to get the contributions from the finance industry, from the school privatization interests and groups, and he certainly started to shift his positions. Not even all that long ago, he would be showing up at rallies where parents in neighborhood schools were defending their schools against incursion of their space by a charter school. In fact, he did that right here in Prospect Heights, not far from where I live. But the influx of money, absolutely, you can see him as a living example of how that functions. However, I think the influence of the money is lubricated by having this virtuous narrative of these reforms are really going to make things better for poor kids. So I think there's a dose of faith as well, along with the money.
We know that the right wing, in fact, it's a matter of record, has long sought to drive a wedge between the two pillars of the Democratic Party, and those are black voters and the unions, and especially
exactly.
The teachers' unions.
That's exactly right.
People who behave as Jeffries behaved, and he is certainly not alone in the black community, are facilitating that wedge, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They absolutely are facilitating that wedge. And of course, in many cases, black voters and union members are the same people. So the attempt to portray their interests as so divergent is always quite bogus. It's not a wedge that is at all inevitable, I guess is what I'm saying. It's sort of outrageous that they get away with it. And I think that it works because, in some ways, because the unions do not always make the best case, that they are really acting in the interests of the entire community and the working class as a whole. And there's certainly a case to be made. They don't always make that case well. But also, a lot of people find these issues just really pretty confusing. And that is another reason why it becomes easy to divide us, because people find the education issues quite intricate and baffling, and ultimately everyone just wants to find the best possible education for their kid. So it's a very easily individualized and privatized issue in that sense. People personally view it as a private issue more than a public issue. It's a very easy wedge to make.
Lisa Featherstone, Assemblyman Jeffries has since renounced a very large offer of money from a major charter school organization.
Activists opposed to the explosion of charter schools in New York and the nation are countering with a human rights model for public education. Dr. Sam Anderson of ICOP, the Independent Commission on Public Education, says charter schools are part of the business model for education.
The business model of education is twofold. One is that somehow you could have an educational system run as a corporation is run. That's one general perspective that the privateers have on public education. And the second that flows from this is that the student is a product and that the teacher is somehow a production line worker in some variation of the classic production line thing, and that the parent is a consumer that has quote-unquote choices.
As they used to say, what's good for business is good for America. Is what's good for business good for education?
That is their rationale. The development of this whole process can be traced back to capital looking for new sources of funding where they can get profits with the minimal amount of effort. And in a world capitalist crisis seen over the past 25 years, and that crisis increasing, they began to look into, in the United States particularly, the now trillion-dollar trough of public education, both in terms of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. This is a bipartisan effort to privatize public education for the sake of having new sources for the corporations to maximize their profits.
And certainly we see the hedge funders trying to cash in, especially on charter schools. How do they convert public education into a profit center?
It's a win-win situation for them. To make a long story short, even if the charter school that they support fails, they really put up no real money. The money that is put up is not theirs. It is the tax dollars' money that is being, quote-unquote, put up. And that for many of these hedge funders, they inflate their portfolio in that manner. In other words, if they support, let's say, a Change First charter school, and that charter school has as its budget $120 million a year, the hedge fund uses that money, that amount, in their fund within their gambling circle. That's how they inflate their own funds. It's all paper shifted around. And so if the school goes under, the hedge fund doesn't lose anything at all because they did not invest any real money out of their pockets into this effort. The money comes from the tax dollars of citizens of New York. And to be very specific, in New York City, the efforts of black folk over some now 17 years ago to fight for fiscal equity in terms of money coming into the state, that fight wound up in a victory that was eventually whittled down to, instead of being somewhere in the vicinity of $24 billion, it was whittled down to around $12 billion. And then inside of that was somewhere around $5 or $6 billion set aside for school buildings and so forth and so on that needed to be improved or built because of the change in the population of New York City, et cetera. And when Bloomberg took over in 2002 and became the controller of all of that money, he redefined the fiscal equity money that black folk and Latinos fought hard for. He redefined that and began to parcel it out more and more to the charter school, hedge fund Wall Streeters.
This would also tend to explain why proponents of charter schools are also proponents of mayoral control of the public schools.
Absolutely. They go hand in hand. It started as a focused New York State / New York City policy that rapidly expanded to other cities across the country. And eventually, when President Obama became president, became part of the national education policy. The race to the top has as a stipulation, if you really want some money, you got to have a mayoral control structure in place, and you got to have charter schools in development.
And some have called that a kind of extortion. The federal government holds or withholds money based upon structuring the public schools in ways that favor entrepreneurs and hedge funders.
Yep, and that's exactly what it is. It's gangsterism, absolutely. And for those few towns that opt out, they don't get the federal money. And then in some cases, some of the federal money that has been allocated in other places, like in Title I, that are obligated to be given, that money is distributed in a very, very slow manner to put a strangle on some of those small towns, those medium-sized cities that are not going along with this. So more and more of the medium-sized cities are being forced to go along with the race to the top stipulations.
Now, these proponents of charter schools and even private, strictly private schools are always ranting and raving about school bureaucracies lording it over the parents and the students. But what you're critiquing is, in fact, a kind of top-down administration, which is what businesses all are.
Right, yes. This was the dream of Giuliani, the former mayor, and to a lesser extent, Dinkins' dream of how do you transform the public school structure into a more corporate model. What they did not have was the financial weight that Bloomberg had and has. That is, he came in as a multi-billionaire tycoon with all kinds of connections, and then added to those connections was his media connections, that he could shape public opinion through media. And so the concept of franchising the school system is about the best way to describe this concept. It became a reality in 2002-2003. That is to say that you have the transformation of the principal as master teacher into the principal as the manager of a franchise, like a McDonald's manager of a franchise. And that you had, therefore, a very narrow, top-down kind of structure developed in a public school system that goes against the grain of education. Because real education is a collaborative effort between parent, student, teacher, and the administration. And the administration being master teachers for the most part themselves. If anybody wants to see what I'm talking about, all they have to do is to go to President Obama's children's school, Sidwell Friends, and see what I'm talking about. That is the model of what, in the United States context, an excellent education model. And there is parental involvement, there is student involvement, and there is an effort to collaborate among teachers and so forth, cross-disciplinary, et cetera, et cetera.
But the charter school supporters and private school supporters say what's needed is choice, and that's what they offer.
The choice concept is the hype, the smokescreen that is thrown out to parents, black and Latino parents, who are desperate to get quality education for their children. When they see the traditional public school being devastated on one hand, and financially being devastated on one hand, or neglected, and at the same time, they see the traditional public school being filled up with inexperienced teachers, the myth of the charter school becomes very, very, very attractive to them. This is their choice. And over and over and over again, those who have now dominated the education reform movement, which they call the reform movement, they throw out this in the media that this is choice and this is the best thing that happens in Harlem or in Bed-Stuy or in East New York. You know, you have choice. In the South Bronx, you got choices now. You got these charter schools and so forth. So that gets tossed up, and it's been a struggle over the past 12 years to show parents that there is really basically no difference between, qualitatively speaking, between a charter school and a traditional public school, and that the choice that you have opted into is a choice that, in fact, makes it much more challenging for your child. Because if your child is not doing well, then they have the option of kicking your child out of school, whereas the traditional public school does not have that option. They're going to have to find a way of teaching your child. That charter school also has the option of not even inviting your child, even though he or she might have won the lottery to get in. Once they're evaluated and show that they may have special needs or they don't speak English as the primary language, they can kick the child out right from the beginning. So that's not what public education is supposed to be about. That's not a democratic form of public education. So that the charter school, a hype, is something that we had to spend years in cutting through, and I think we're about to make some breakthroughs in that in terms of on-the-ground organizing around with parents and oftentimes with a lot of the elected officials, too.
And what you're offering is something that you call a human rights model of education.
Yes, absolutely. The human rights model of education has a very, very long tradition that is rooted in Black America in the 17th century and the 18th century in terms of our struggle, in spite of being enslaved, our struggle to learn. We saw that as a human right to be knowledgeable about the world. And that informed our movements. That informed our anti-slavery struggle. That informed the fundamental basis of many of the original Black churches, because that's where public education started, in these original Black churches in the 1700s in New York and in Philadelphia. We see that as a continuation of that tradition and as a human right. And in the contemporary scene, in the latter part of the 20th century, that has become an international development. On the international level, forces in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and parts of Europe have already moved and developed basic principles that education is a human right. And so we are re-embracing our African-American tradition around education and embracing the international conception of education as a human right. And that what that means is that education as a human right trumps the constitutionality of the United States, trumps the efforts to abort the civil rights measures that were fought and won in the 1950s in Brown v. Board and what followed after that. So that we are also, therefore, in the tradition of Brother Malcolm, who had raised this issue of our struggle in the United States in the 1960s, was a struggle for human rights, not just civil rights, but a struggle for human rights. So all of those things are now dovetailing into this effort to show and to build a new system, a new public school system that's based, grounded in this whole reality of education as a human right. It's a democratic, anti-racist reality. Education is a human right, and we want to develop a public school system in New York City that will reflect that.
How does a human rights model contrast with the business model?
A human rights model is about promoting the intellectual excellence, intellectual development of a child to their maximum capabilities. A human rights model is about having direct parental involvement in decision-making at the public school level. A human rights model is about having teachers actually know what they're teaching and having teachers engaged in interacting and decision-making processes along with the parents and the students. A human rights model has student involvement in decision-making basis. A human rights model embraces the notion of an African-centered education for people of African descent, embraces the notion of a Latino-centered education for those people of Latino descent, and similarly with the Asian population, embraces the notion that education must be fundamentally anti-racist, that at the root of this society is white supremacy, and that we have to find educational mechanisms to struggle against white supremacy, both in terms of the white population in this society as well as the internalization that impacts people of color in this society. The human rights model sees education as a non-linear, complex, holistic development of the child. That is, the community must be engaged in the child's development. And the child must see and must embrace the community, their respective community, in that development. It also sees the necessity for the child to be civic-minded in this whole process. So that the African notion that it takes a whole village to educate the child becomes a reality, because that is how one is really and truly educated, as opposed to the corporate model, which is all about confining and defining anti-intellectual widget that can fit into either a low-level position in the corporate world or in prison.
This seems to be community control writ large for the 21st century.
Absolutely. We are taking up that banner of the struggle for community control that happened in the 1960s. In fact, in our work over the years, we studied that, we interviewed people, we discussed with people who were involved in that, and came up with what were the positive things that came out of that struggle, and what were some of the drawbacks that came out in order to figure out how we move forward in this notion that it's a righteous notion, it's a necessary notion of the community controls the schools. We know that's the case in Deer Park, Long Island. We know that's the case in Westchester County and most of the towns in Westchester County and elsewhere. We know that. We're saying we're going to rethink, reevaluate, critique it, that whole experience of 40 some odd years ago, and rebuild on that. And that's what we're in the process of doing.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.